Ireland is getting older. That presents a unique set of challenges that we, as a nation, as a population, are going to have to rise to. I'm Peter Kavanagh, and this is The Old Country, a podcast about ageing in Ireland brought to you by Active Retirement Ireland, in association with the Community Foundation, as part of the UN Decade of Healthy Ageing. Welcome to The Old Country. I'm Peter Kavanagh, and I'm delighted that we're joined again by Professor Kieran Walsh from the Irish Centre for Social Gerontology in the National University of Ireland in Galway. And Kieran, a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about ageing in place, and we were talking about the difficulties of social inclusion and how to reach people, how to talk to them, how to get them more involved in society, among the many other things our meandering track of conversations took us to. But one of the key things you said was that we have to acknowledge the diversity of people involved. And that was such an interesting one I wanted to speak to you about, because we are essentially sold this very homogenous image of older people in Ireland. And it doesn't really stand up to scrutiny these days.
Hmm.
I mean, we've got a much more diverse older population in Ireland than one might think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, in preparation for this, I think you were asking at one point what's unique about us. And in some ways, there's a couple of things. One is the pace of change that we talked about in the context of aging in place. The other is our population composition. That's because at the moment we're currently a little bit younger. But it is that assumption of homogeneity, which is really interesting. And I don't think we were ever homogeneous, because on one level you can describe the population at, maybe 15, 20, 25 years ago as being predominantly of a certain religious faith, of being a predominant race, ethnicity, and so on. But even at that, there was massive cohort differences. And, in terms of our previous conversation, or even probably in the course of this conversation, we're going to trip into the idea that, we talk about older people as this group, but you're talking about 40, maybe 50 years of a population change there, and you're talking about very different cohort experiences and different expectations around that. And then you do layer that now with what is this emerging diversity of kind of what we would see as the standard diverse ethnic groups, this standard kind of social categorizations or locations. So now we're thinking about ethnicity. Now we need to think about different levels of disability. Now we need to think about different socioeconomic backgrounds, sexuality, all of these different aspects. And that's something that's really key, because we're not there yet, and we need to combine that with the sort of cohort differences. And when I start talking about cohort differences, I just mean that, I have relatives in their 80s and 90s, so they were born and they might have lived through periods of even the economic war and all this kind of stuff. There's people who would have grown up in the 50s, people who would have grown up in the 60s, 70s. They all come with different ideas, different needs, and different expectations. And then you have these groups that are growing older in Ireland, perhaps for the first time. So you have these ethnic communities. We have older travellers, indigenous and ethnic communities, which for some reason we always regarded as, because of life expectancy, because everything else, there wasn't older populations to really speak about there. But there always was, and we needed to consider that, and we didn't. And then there's many other groups, as I said, that we're now getting a little bit better at recognising at a certain level, but not in terms of policy and practice. And I would say, particularly in terms of public consciousness as well, and actually some people at the practice level are very good at recognising that diversity because they work and support it every day. But certainly in our own public awareness, in the way that we frame and refer to ageing, the way you hear passing conversations, we're not as good as we need to be in terms of recognizing that heterogeneity and what that actually means as well for people's everyday lives.
Yeah, it's one of the things that will drive people mad is seeing, that 65 plus age box on a form or something, as if everything after that point is exactly the same. So we have a track record of not considering the generational differences, among older people already.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's only worse when you think that, we've got a very bad record of examining things like gender identity, sexuality, ethnic background, even class or educational attainment. There's so many different things that lead to essentially make up the person that you are. And we may have a sort of a tendency to categorise all older people as just older people. That's the only thing. And I know in public policy, it's been a criticism of the way Ireland has approached older people for a long time that, you know, up until the age of 65, you've so many different departments looking after you, per se. Like, just saying, like, you know, if you have a disability, then, you know, the Department of Health has something to do with you, or you might be interested in culture. So that's the Department of Culture and Heritage and Gaelic and so on and so forth. But as soon as you hit 65, well, then your file, your little box, goes over into one little office in the Department of Health, and all older people's issues from there on for the rest of your days go there. Like, and people in receipt of disability grants, for example, would have really, really suffered from this, because as soon as they turn 65, they're no longer eligible. They go on to older people's payments and are sort of cut off. So all of the supports that they had been getting, well, it's known you're one of the older people now, so you get your pension and that's it, and good luck to you. And that really just shows that we have not put a lot of thought over the years into just how different and diverse the needs of our older population are. So what can we do to improve that?
I think the simple idea is that, you know, even forgetting about diversity for a second, we just need to raise our level of expectation about what we can achieve in later life. And to I suppose, reflect what's actually happening on an everyday basis within policy and practice and within the goals that we set for that, which is really essential and really important. I think, look, we mentioned, I think, the Green Paper the last time. I think what stood out from that in terms of the Green Paper for Ageing from the European Commission was that there was a lack of ambition. Mm. You know, there wasn't really any sort of, hey, you know, there is a really, you know, powerful period here that we have gained in terms of life expectancy, and look at all these different things that we could possibly do with it, or to actually just, you know, support and empower the agency that older people have to live their lives in the multitude of different ways that they want to. And I think that's really fundamentally important. So then I suppose what that means in terms of structures and systems, it means, you know, if we take something like the National Positive Ageing Strategy, which was supposed to be an intergovernment policy.
It was supposed to be a lot of things, all right.
Well, okay. But if, you know, if we take that and you think about the people who were actually tasked with the delivery of it, you know, that was a huge responsibility on the people primarily within the Department of Health. Mm. And we just weren't able to seem to connect that up with other areas of major policy making, such as social protection, such as housing, such as community, such as all these different things. And some of those have improved, some of them haven't. And I think, number one, there has to be a collective responsibility there. And it's a responsibility that has to be mirrored then all the way down. In some ways, that has happened. A little bit, you know, in terms of local authorities and the HSE, regional bodies working together. But we certainly have to get better in that. And I suppose if you take what happened in the last year and you look at the way that the policies have been drafted, you know, some of it out of good sentiment and good ideas, but some of it out of a sort of paternalism of homogenization that we all are now familiar with the critical side of and the sort of ageism is there. I mean, there was a couple of things why that happened. One was that there wasn't any other frame. You know, there wasn't any other set of government departments you could go to and think, okay, what are the different things that we need to do in terms of the social side, in terms of equality and justice, in terms of housing, accommodation, communities, whatever the case was. And that kicked in different ways, but not at that overall level. So what it does is that it really fragments the sort of solutions that we can try and think about in the sort of space. So the natural thing was to say, well, if we're responding to a pandemic, then our pandemic response is probably going to be primarily in terms of health and public health. And that's what it is, because that's what it's always been anyway, to a degree, for older people. So that's really exposed that. And I suppose in the context then of going back to even some of those ideas of homogenization and not recognising diversity, is that, you know, what it's really shown is that there is systemic ageism that we still need to combat. And that ageism is pervasive in the way it's kind of gone through different forms of policies, different forms of discourse over the years. And I would say, again, it's primarily actually on the social side you know, on the public discourse side, that we have to be very conscious about that and find new ways to try and tackle that, and to really, again, embrace kind of these full models of participation and engagement for older people. That is really important to do that. And then if we're doing that for older people, what we have to make sure is that, yes, we're recognising the differences. So there's massive differentials in terms of needs, in terms of agency, that we have to support and engage with in different ways. So it might be about supporting people in one way, but it could be actually about harnessing what they're doing in other ways. So there's that piece. And then we have to recognise that there's all these other groups across different populations that are ageing, that are getting older, and we need to factor them in to our policy that is impacting older people. And on the other side, whatever sectors are tasked with looking after them have to factor in older adults in relation to their policies as well. So again, we're talking about the traveller community, homeless community, we're talking about ethnic and minority groups, we're talking about LGBT and so on, all of these different groups. And sometimes, you know, we still very much neglect their perspectives in the context of older adult policy, as well as neglecting the perspectives of older adults itself. And I suppose in a lot of ways that comes about by trying to create proper ways of engaging a diverse population in terms of policy formation and in terms of practice delivery. So, you know, there's a lot of airtime given to ideas of co-production, everything else. Aim for that. But at the core, just make sure that there's some sort of sustainable consultation structure in there for older people and for a diverse group of older people. Because otherwise, we're not going to be able to really benefit from the diversity and the heterogeneity that is there.
Yeah, it sort of speaks to a couple of key theories. And like the first one is the one that we say and we hear all the time, nothing about us without us. And that makes obviously perfect sense to anybody listening. If you are of a group of people and there's a public policy piece to be done that directly affects your cohort, the people that are the same as you, your community, then you should at the very least be consulted on it. And then around this idea that a lot of consultation, unfortunately, and we found it in the older people sector, a lot of consultation, unfortunately, is just box ticking. It's not real consultation, and it's certainly not collaboration. It's certainly not bringing people on board with the decision making process. And we've seen that in our structures, in local authorities. You know, there are some really, really good progressive ones, the ones who are leading the way on Age Friendly Ireland. They're really brilliant at getting older people on board, and the older people's councils and the age friendly groups and communities in the counties are leading the charge, and they're being heard. But in a lot of cases, it's just a case of, well, here's what the county engineers have prepared. There you go. Thanks a million. We'll see you next month. And there's no real input there. So we do need to up our game nationally and making sure that whatever consultation is there is meaningful, and it actually includes the voices of people in whatever final product you're producing.
Yeah, it's ultimately about trying to include the people that are going to be impacted by it, and also about recognising the fact that actually your whatever might be policy practice, even community and voluntary initiatives, and I would definitely include research in that as well, that all of these different programmes, projects, whatever, are better when and are more relevant and impactful if you actually match them to people's lived experience. And if you, at a certain point, you have to kind of come down with a particular framework and structure that helps you direct and helps you make decisions and progress things. That's absolutely the case. But the point is that if there's insights out there, harness those insights. Let those insights flow through. And that also creates better ownership. It creates better alignment with what people are going to actually do and react to within their lives as well. So there's a couple of ways to look at this. One is that, okay, there is that lack of consultation. Permanent, sustainable consultation structures. Sorry, that's what I should emphasise that. The second is that when we do have those consultations, sometimes we're consulting with people that we're always consulting with. Mm-hmm. I would say that in older people as well. I mean, there was a community nearby us, and we used to call it, the community and then say it was the bias that seemed to drift up through every national study we knew of, because they were involved in every national study. And I think there is a real need there for the community and voluntary sector, for us in research, for policy, to ensure that the people that we're consulting with is a representative group. And that's not to undermine the contributions that people are making within these roles when there's the same old people who are being consulted over and over again, because that's really important that they're doing that. But we have to make sure who are the groups that are harder to reach. Mm. And how do we find an appropriate way of harnessing their voice, which is really, really a challenge. And it's always been a challenge for us in research. I mean, we're conducting projects on people who were excluded or people who were isolated, and you always kind of come away thinking, did we really talk to the people who were really excluded? You know, and that is a fundamental issue. And by asking ourselves that question constantly, we're in a better position to actually be able to recognise limitations of what we're doing, including consultation, including policy development. But we have to try and progress that.
Yeah, well, we spoke on the podcast a couple of weeks ago to one of our development officers within Active Retirement Ireland, and you know, we got into those ideas of, you know, there's really no point in, and we were talking in particular about social exclusion, isolation, loneliness, and there's no point putting in place something without the input of people who are socially excluded, who are isolated, who are lonely. You can't build a program of activities that they'll want to take part in without asking them what they want to take part in. But you can't really ask them that easily because they're socially excluded, they're isolated, and you don't have ready access to them. So look, it's a constant challenge, but there are obviously things that we can do better, like right on the surface of stuff we could change how we do things within research, within community and voluntary groups, within public policy practice. We could do it tomorrow. And my least favourite genre of podcast, I should say, is two white guys talking about the lived experience of others. But unfortunately, we're going to have to do that for just a little bit. But it is the likes of older LGBTQ plus people. You know, it is the likes of older travellers. It's the likes of older people who are from different ethnic backgrounds than white Irish. And they've been absent from the conversation for a very long period of time, a very long period of time. And there is this idea of, and maybe you might just explain it, not just for our listeners, but for me as well. There is this idea of cumulative disadvantage as well, that if you're coming from a marginalised community and then you grow older and you have to deal with the marginalisation that happens to older people, it's significantly worse if you've been marginalised your entire life.
Yeah, it's a very simple idea, it's just about the fact that sometimes if you encounter certain risks at earlier stages in your life, you may be more likely to encounter risks throughout your life. So that's one piece. And then as you do that, you enter later life with more risks, basically. In the same way that if you have encountered certain advantages, there's a higher potential for you to encounter more opportunities, more advantages, more good things. And that continues on through later life as well. So there's a couple of ways of looking at that. One is that you can think then about the groups who have always been disadvantaged. And again, we can think about, I would have mentioned the last time that we did some work on older travellers and older homeless adults, and particularly around the travellers. I mean, I would have consider myself to be somewhat sensitive to the issues around the traveller community, to be aware of the circumstances, but really struck by the massive set of deprivations that they've experienced. Mm. And that's not out of a position of political correctness. The deprivations are tangible.
Yeah, they're measurable. It's an objective fact that school leaving age on average was an awful lot lower for travellers. Life expectancy was an awful lot lower for travellers. Is an awful lot lower for members of the travelling community.
So yeah, and then there's structural issues there that you can point to, as well as literacy and just general confidence to be able to negotiate things. But the structural issues that are really significant. And you see populations like that, then you see these populations coming through into older life who are carrying those disadvantages, as well as any age-related changes that might be happening, both in terms of you in your personal life, but also in terms of how society reacts to you, because now you're older, so you're not participating economically, you're not doing anything, so how do we react to you in that context? And that's one aspect which is really important. The other aspect goes to another piece of work that we were doing around critical life transitions. And it's about acknowledging that things can happen in our lives, but also in later life, that can actually totally change our life trajectory. It can change our life transition. And obviously, the one that we always think about is health and disability, which is absolutely the case. And in that piece of work, we were looking at people with the onset of dementia, both early onset and late life onset, and how that has changed people's lives, very much so. And at the same time, it's to recognise that a lot of people, you know, preserve the continuity of identity and so on within that, which is really important. But it creates these sort of changes that have to be adapted to. And whether you're supported to adapt to those changes or not is a key factor. Think about bereavement and how that impacts on people. And you think about other transitions that impact on people's lives that we aren't always associated with older people. So we did a piece of work with forced migrants who are coming in through the forced migration channels and family unification.
So this is fascinating, because we have communities throughout the country that have reacted with open arms to people coming in from places like Syria and the likes, but now we have family reunification, and of course we have older cohorts within those. So it's absolutely fascinating, because it's not something that is you immediately think of when you think of, you know, refugee communities, migrant communities coming to Ireland.
No, and yet people on the ground are working with this for a long time, and maybe my fault, I'm a bit late in getting out some of the outputs of that project, but those outputs will come out in the next few weeks, next 8 weeks maybe. And hopefully what that'll do is just identify the fact that we need to pay attention. And particularly, I mean, for instance, people working in county councils, people working in those emergency resettlement centres to support them and so on, you know, they're coming across these issues a lot more than at the national policy or advocacy levels, which is really interesting, because at national levels, not always kind of linked in with what's actually happening on the ground in some respects. And people are saying, yeah, if you're thinking of people who are over the age of 50, which is what we regard kind of qualification to a lot of ageing studies now as being, because you want to get that longer life course period, then you are hitting families, you're hitting people coming in with children, but then family unification adds on to that, and you're getting the older groups as well, the older age groups in with that as well. So we do really have to pay attention to those aspects and what they mean in terms of accumulating risk. So it's about the disadvantaged groups who are getting older, and it's about those events and transitions that can happen in our lives that creates a disadvantage. And we have to just make sure that we are supporting people who are already demonstrating huge agency and resilience to be able to adapt to these changes, but to make sure that those adaptions are sustainable, as long as they can be, depending on what we're talking about.
Is there an element that, like, we're really, really behind on this one, and we should have seen this coming? I understand, like, with forced migrants, perhaps it's a more... although not necessarily, I was about to say perhaps it's a more recent phenomenon, but perhaps not, because there were
mid-90s.
Been a lot of people.
If you think about when we were first really monitoring the kind of net inward migration that was reacting to our own better situation.
I take it that the mid-90s was when we started monitoring it, but we would have had cohorts coming in from Vietnam as early as the 70s.
Absolutely, and there was
forced migrants were coming in.
Yeah, and there was communities all the way back, absolutely. Yeah. But then there's other migrant communities as well. I mean, even where I'm from myself, down around West Cork, you know, there's groups of people who would come in, and not groups, but there would have been sections of the community that would have been foreign national, whether it was English, German, Dutch, whatever the case was. But a lot of those people have made their lives in Ireland and don't hold some of those disadvantages, and some do. And we have to be conscious of that and make sure that, you know, they're a part of that.
Yeah. When it comes to other cohorts, though, like, is it really not a case that we definitely should have seen this coming, in that, like, if you think about it, just to look at the LGBTQ plus community, Norris versus Ireland was over 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So anybody who was around 25, 30 when homosexuality was decriminalised in Ireland is now eligible for these ageing studies, as you say. They're all over 50 now at this stage. When you think about pioneers of the transgender rights movement, the likes of Dr. Lydia Foy, and the likes, these are people now in their 60s, in their 70s. And you can look back as far as you want in history and find isolated incidents here and there of people living their lives expressing the real gender identity that they feel. And we've seen those right through history, and yet we're now sort of we're here in the 2020s looking at, God, we really haven't done much on older trans people or older gay people or older travellers or older migrants. We don't have the body of research, we don't have the public policy, we don't have that statement. Are we have we had our head in the sand basically for 30 years or what's the issue?
Well, some would say it was longer than 30 years. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, like to a degree, absolutely. To another degree, you know, we've been bad enough at trying to acknowledge the mainstream older population in different ways, in the ways that we talked about there, in terms of consultation, in terms of engagement, in terms of what we want later life to be. So it's not surprising, really, that we're not breaking it down. What I'd focus on is the potential here. And to recognise the fact that, I'm aware that this is for Active Retirement Association members as well, to recognise the fact that sometimes actually the conditions and circumstances of people even on the most marginalised positions in society, sometimes there can be overlapping issues with the mainstream older population, if you want to use that kind of homogenising term again, that we need to account for, and that sometimes by looking at the margins we have better insights into how to make our policy better for everybody in terms of older people. So that's in the context of home care. And it's about thinking about maybe thinking about home care thresholds at the age of 65 or whatever it is mightn't be the best approach. Maybe we're better off to adapt a more life course approach in terms of thinking about need, in terms of thinking about disadvantage and issues around exclusion that impact on health. And thinking about these kind of tools that we can use to not just provide instrumental and maybe emotional needs, but also about trying to promote integration. And I mean that in terms of bringing people into the community and creating connectedness and everything else with them. There has to be a little bit of understanding that sometimes there are shared issues and sometimes there needs to be issues that have to be targeted by specific policies as well.
I do find that really fascinating because we've been saying it in Active Retirement for years, and it's kind of a mantra of age friendly communities the world over as well, is that if you target something, if you have a policy intervention for older people, it benefits everybody. And that can be as simple as like if you try and think of age friendly things like they did in Ennis in 2012. There was a group of transition year students in Ennis in County Clare, and they decided that their transition year project would be to try and make Ennis age friendly. And so what they managed to do was they got onto the local town council, as it was at the time, and they got a few of the curbs lowered, and they got the traffic lights, the pedestrian lights, to last 15 seconds longer to cross the road. And they were thanked not only by the older population, but by parents who were trying to push buggies around, or by people with disabilities, or even people just trying to get their shopping back to the car. They just made life that little bit better by taking such a tiny, tiny decision that the motorists didn't even notice. You know, so in essence, if we could harness that kind of approach and say, if you look at things that seem on the surface to affect the most marginalised, if you put in place something for those people who we have historically ignored and not done anything, actually it could have massive benefits for, as you say, mainstream older people, mainstream older society.
Yes, no, and it's not to go too far with that one, because at the same time we run the risk of homogenising things, and we're familiar with those arguments about age-friendly communities and age-friendly for older people is age-friendly for everybody. It depends. It depends on your preferences. It depends on everything else. So we're all individuals in that respect. But at the same time, yes, absolutely, that if we're looking at kind of key policies, a lot of these issues are impacting people in the same way, but perhaps not to the same degree. And so I'll give you a sense of that. We did some work a good few years ago now on deprivation measures and how you measure deprivation. And we did it with diverse and subgroups of older population, as well as kind of what would be regarded as a general representative group of kind of the general older population as well. And some of the things were the kind of same sort of issues that were coming up. But the degree at which it was impacting people was the issue. But what it showed was that there was some commonalities there in terms of those experiences. And by looking at the people on the margins, as well as those in the middle, if you like, we had a better sense of, I suppose, the full way in which these issues can actually impact on our population as a whole, as an entirety. And then on the other side of it, there was things that were specific that, for instance, some of the diverse groups were relevant in their lives that weren't relevant to other people, and that reflected the sort of deprivations they had lived with throughout their lives. So if I take you back to that project that I spoke to you about, the older traveller and older homeless individuals, you know, when they were talking about and articulating preferences for home care, number one, there was an issue in terms of projecting into the future. particularly for homeless older adults, because a lot of people are just focused on the now, trying to get through on a daily basis.
I think quite understandably.
Absolutely. We're not very good at planning anyway, as a general population, but there is that aspect of it. The second aspect is about expectations relative appreciation. So a lot of people we talk to be honest, weren't probably as the hardest to reach within that hard to reach group, if you like. So some of the people were already plugged into services, so they had a huge appreciation for what they were getting. Mm-hmm. And it was hard to say, well, what would you actually really want out of this? And then for those, and everybody did articulate their preferences, and then in terms of looking at those preferences, the preferences around things like home care became more about enabling life in so many ways, and again reacted to some of those disadvantages that people had. So it was a huge focus for both of the populations, not surprisingly, on accommodation, on security of tenure, and security of and high quality housing and all this. And not even high quality, just standard, adequate housing. There was this idea of social connectedness and social relationships, because certainly loneliness would be impacting on some of those population groups. There was this idea of kind of almost enabling a re-engagement with life. So if you think about some of the older homeless adults who were perhaps now trying to move back into a situation where they could live on their own, and just very simple things like self-care, about meal preparation, all these sort of things. And I think until we realise that for certain groups you have these massive disadvantages you have to account for, and to do it with a sort of an intensity and scope that is proportional to those sort of disadvantages, we're always going to not be able to achieve a fully equitable ageing society. And that's a key aspect. And I think that proportional universal bit is to do with determinants of health, which is a fundamental kind of idea that we have to think about.
I think it's absolutely fascinating, because as you mentioned at the outset of when you were saying, like, we've never been that good at including older people, in the conversation. So it's kind of it's not a surprise that we're not as good at including these marginalised groups of older people in there. So do you think that the possibilities are strong that we can not only start to get older people in as part of the conversation, but also the heterogeneity of older people to make that form a crucial part? Would you have any tangible hopes for the future around that?
No, I would, because I think a lot of people who are actually working in within the sector, across the sector, in voluntary, community, private as well, and public, are doing it out of commitment. I don't think anybody is doing it out of a pay pack or anything like that. I think there is actually a commitment and interest in supporting older populations. I think sometimes we haven't created, or we haven't been very good at enabling the opportunity structures that allow people who are working with and on behalf of older people to really realise that potential. So we need to do that. So it's about saying, actually, yeah, we want consultation. Now, there is things to point to. I mean, the public engagement and patient involvement piece within the HSE is very good, and some people are very good, but at least it's going in the right direction. And I think it's about saying, okay, how do we sustain that in a meaningful way, and how do we try and achieve that for all different population groups? And if we're honest about what that commitment needs to be, whether it's resourcing or prioritization, then the question comes then, well, how do we create the methods and the means to actually be able to do it? And that's a fundamental question as well. So one is about the impetus and motivation and resourcing, and one is about the actual mechanisms to be able to do it. And look, there's pilot studies, there is lots of things to point to where we can actually do that, which is a positive sense. One of the biggest challenges, I would say, in Ireland for older people, for all of us as well, is to recognise the fact that we haven't, you might have mentioned it, haven't developed an equality discourse around ageing for older people, and to create a cohesive voice that pushes that discourse. And I guess what we've always talked about, going back to what we talked about earlier on, is about health and older people in that association. But we do need to break that. We need to think about aging as being a little bit of a call to arms in terms of creating that equality element. So I suppose the last year has really demonstrated that at different points, we didn't have that capacity amongst older people, amongst older groups, amongst different kind of sections that are all working with older people, to really be able to kind of stand up and say, listen, there are some things here that are really beneficial in terms of measures around COVID-19, and there are some measures that we don't agree with, and there are some measures that we're going to react to. And certainly that was very understandable in some parts of that development, because people were so concerned about public health and not wanting to go against messaging and everything else. But I think, you know, if we look at across what we have, even if we look at active retirement associations, there is such a huge potential there for people to create that capacity and to really impact on some of these big issues, whether they're issues that we've always contended with, like care, or whether there's issues that we haven't foreseen yet that might come. And it's about reacting to that, and it's about saying, hey, listen, there's a cohesive voice here to a certain extent that says you have to figure in older people into these planning processes. You have to figure in older people into these consultation processes. And it's about saying as well to policymakers and practitioners that, you know, we're willing to do that. And obviously that has always been there, but it's about constantly reminding them of that. And I think the better we're at creating that sort of capacity, the better we will be at producing and advocating and lobbying and inputting into policy and practice. And I do mean, you know, the research side of things has an important role to play there as well. And I would certainly say that, you know, research hasn't always been good at that, and we need to be a little bit more flexible in how we fit into that process too.
Yeah, obviously that advocacy piece is going to be vitally important over the next 10 years, over this decade of healthy aging. And it's certainly something that should be in all of our consciousnesses about it. I suppose it's interesting, and just as a last note before we wrap up this episode, that you mentioned that the pandemic has sort of, you know, it's shone a light on a few things, and it's sort of shown us what we can be doing. We can talk about the reactions that we had to certain public health measures in the pandemic and the likes. But I think the one thing that it has shown, and I hate to be sort of coming towards the end on a slightly negative note, But it has shown that when it comes to, you know, whatever the hierarchy of advocacy voices is, that older people were still very much in the halfpenny place. That, you know, compared to, you know, the likes of big business, compared to the likes of vintners, restaurateurs, you know, retail associations and the likes, older people, I guarantee it, they were complaining about things like cocooning. You know, they were complaining about things like lockdowns and inability to visit relatives in nursing home and the like. There was no impact. It just felt that this was an advocacy voice that was easily shelved or easily put to one side in the name of an understandable public health emergency. But it sort of shows that there's a lot of work to be done yet to strengthen that equality discourse and to make that advocacy voice louder.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right, and I think that has to be creating that openness amongst kind of governing structures, whatever level they are. But it's also about giving ourselves the confidence, and I include myself in that, I don't think I'm too far from the different age thresholds now at this stage, to realise that we can speak up, we can resist some of these things that are coming down as well. I mean, what really happened was that the pandemic, both itself and the management of it, stripped kind of agency, and it almost shelved it all for all of us to say, this is so challenging, this is so damaging, that you just have to, you know, bury your head in the hatches and see if you can get through. And even for someone like myself, who's supposed to be kind of looking at what's happening and responding and commentating on what's happening, for a while, you know, the amount of things that were happening was just overwhelming. And the sort of ways that particularly homogenization and all these different ideas were coming out and driving the degree of exclusions that were happening for older people was huge. And then on top of that, you lay in the sort of longstanding issues we've always faced, such as digital literacy, digital exclusion. You know, all of those things have really kind of come to the fore. So we have to look at it. What I would say is that, you know, whether we're through the pandemic or not, and I don't think we are, but whatever way it unfolds in terms of the vaccination rollout and everything else, we do have to think about the way we can create solutions now. And I suppose those solutions have to be around connectedness, But they also have to be dealing with some of the fundamentals that we're talking about. And that's about rights, it's about dignity, it's about identity in the context of ageing. And I think that's a really important element. And it is, again, I'll go back to this idea about really kind of embracing a bigger ambition for what later life could be. And please don't interpret this as being as all active ageing and healthy ageing. I mean, I would sometimes critique those ideas and saying, well, look, who are we talking about healthy ageing and active ageing for, and where are we talking for? It's even age-friendly. You know, there's a diversity of communities and places there that we have to make sure are reflected in all those policies, and I don't think sometimes they are. So, you know, it is about saying, let's just create those opportunities, and then whoever wants to or can engage with them, then we'll support that engagement and support that agency, and that's really a fundamental piece, really.
Yeah. And as well as that, we'll just have to make sure that, you know, those that are not engaging, we've got to reach out. We've got to constantly reach out. We've got to try and get to those who are socially isolated. We've got to try to get to those who feel excluded from society. And 'cause it's, you know, it's not enough to say if you build it, they will come. There's a lot of people you need to make that extra.
No, absolutely. And you have to. And I think when I'm talking about opportunities and structures is that you're essentially creating a sort of wrap of opportunities, of choices and everything else for people to make. But you have to make sure that they get to people. And that's a fundamental piece. We can talk about agency and exclusion in a different one if you want.
We might have to, yeah. Listen, we'll have to leave it there. Professor Kieran Walsh from the Irish Centre for Social Gerontology in NUI Galway, thanks a million for joining us.
That's all. Thank you, Peter.
The Old Country is recorded in the podcast studios, McGuinness Place, Dublin 2. For more information, check out thepodcaststudios.ie. This podcast is brought to you by Active Retirement Ireland as part of the UN Decade of Healthy Ageing. This podcast is supported by the Community Foundation for Ireland, and thanks, as always, to our media partners, Alice PR.